Before we start, one clear line so nobody mistakes the frame. Some of the evidence in this episode is real and current. Some of the scenes we describe are future-facing speculation. We are not pretending to report from a future boardroom. We are trying to map the future that current incentives seem to be building, and the current evidence is already sharp enough to hurt. As of this week, the live tracker at layoffs.fyi shows more than 73,000 tech employees laid off in 2026 alone. That number does not prove every dismissal came from AI. It does prove the labor market is already fragile, already under pressure, already primed for companies to justify smaller teams. Then layer on what the IMF has been saying. Almost 40% of jobs globally are exposed to AI, and in advanced economies, the share is roughly 60%. Layer on the World Economic Forum's 2025 Future of Jobs report, where employers across more than 14 million workers say AI and information processing are among the most transformative forces hitting business before 2030. So today's question is not, will AI matter for white-collar work? That question is finished. The question is this: when big tech cuts headcount in the AI era, what exactly is disappearing first? Because I think most people are looking in the wrong direction. They imagine one cinematic moment when a model gets good enough and a whole job category vanishes overnight. Maybe that happens in a few places, but I think the deeper story is uglier and more plausible. I think the first thing to really collapse is not the entire org chart. It is the career ladder, the training ladder, the awkward, expensive, slow human ramp that used to turn interns into coordinators, coordinators into managers, and junior engineers into people who could actually steer important systems. With me is Dana Vale, a fictional composite I'm using for exactly this kind of conversation. Part operator, part workforce strategist, part person who has sat close enough to budgeting meetings to know that the language of efficiency can sound calm right up until it starts erasing futures. Dana, I want to start with the most important distinction in this whole episode. Layoffs are already real. AI pressure is already real. But what do smart people still get wrong when they try to connect those two things?
They get the timing wrong, and because they get the timing wrong, they get the mechanism wrong. A lot of people still imagine AI layoffs as a dramatic one-step substitution. The model does the work, the human disappears. That story is emotionally satisfying because it is clean. It gives you a villain, a victim, and a trigger. But in real companies, especially big tech companies, labor displacement usually moves through budgeting logic, not science fiction moments. Here's the less cinematic sequence. First, AI increases the amount of output a strong worker can produce. Maybe one product manager can support more surface area because research, synthesis, drafts, specs, and analysis all get faster. Maybe one engineer can move faster through documentation, debugging, test generation, internal tooling, and code scaffolding. Maybe one recruiter or support lead can process more work because triage, drafting, and screening all get cheaper. At that stage, most companies do not immediately announce, "Wonderful, now we can fire half the team." They do something quieter. They slow hiring. They stop backfilling. They merge adjacent scopes. They ask whether a team that used to need 10 people can now function with 8. And because finance people love compounding, the answer does not have to be yes with certainty. It only has to be yes often enough. Then comes the more dangerous shift. Once a leadership team believes the next generation of tools will be better than the current one, they start planning around future leverage, not present leverage. That matters enormously. You get organizations cutting to the staffing model they think they will need 18 months from now, not the one they needed last year. And that is where the ladder starts to break, because senior people who already know the system can absorb tooling improvements immediately. Junior people are still expensive in the old way. They require coaching, time, review, correction, patience, and slack. If a company believes AI can cover part of the same territory, the easiest thing to cut is not always the highest paid veteran. Sometimes it is the next 10 people who were supposed to become veterans later. That is why I say the mechanism is not simply replacement. It is organizational compression, fewer rungs, narrower intake, higher performance expectations per surviving human.
Organizational compression. Good. Hold on to that phrase because I think it is the center of the whole episode. We have had automation stories before and people always say some version of the same reassuring thing. Yes, some jobs go away, but new jobs appear. Yes, tools destroy old tasks, but they create new demand. Yes, labor markets adjust. And in the longest possible view, that can be true. It can even be true while millions of people still get crushed in the transition. But I think the white-collar version of this story has a twist that a lot of very comfortable analysts still refuse to stare at. The old white-collar bargain was not just pay for work, it was apprenticeship disguised as employment. You got hired partly because the company needed output right now, but also because it needed a pipeline. Juniors were messy, associates were inefficient, new grads asked basic questions, first-time managers made ugly mistakes. But the machine worked because those people were becoming the people the company would rely on later. What AI changes is not only the economics of task execution, it changes leadership patience. If I am a CFO and every quarter I hear that the next model will be more agentic, more autonomous, more useful in research, writing, coding, support, analysis, sales prep, legal drafting, and internal ops, why would I invest in a big human bench? Why would I preserve a fat middle of partially trained workers if I believe my highest performers plus better systems can cover more of the map next year? And once that belief locks in, you get a really chilling possibility. Companies keep telling the public a familiar line: we are focused on efficiency, reallocation, strategic investment, streamlining the org. But under that bland language, they are doing something much more consequential. They are deciding that the old route into the professional class is too expensive to maintain. Dana, take that one level deeper for me. If the career ladder gets thinner before total headcount collapses, what does that look like inside a real company? Not in theory. In actual workflow, actual staffing decisions, actual meeting language.
It looks like a company that still says it believes in talent development while quietly redesigning itself around talent scarcity at the bottom. Imagine the planning cycle. The executive team is reviewing cost structure. Cloud spend is up because everyone wants more model access, more inference, more experimentation, more internal tooling. There is pressure to prove AI investment is not a vanity project. So someone asks the obvious question: where do we fund the compute, the tooling, the acquisitions, the specialist hires, the premium infrastructure? One answer is revenue growth. Another is margin discipline. The cleanest short-term source of margin discipline is labor. But the cuts do not need to arrive as a single headline. They can arrive as a set of policies. Hiring plans move from broad funnel to surgical requisitions only. Entry-level recruiting programs shrink because leaders say they want fewer but stronger candidates. Internal documentation improves because teams expect AI-assisted onboarding to substitute for some human coaching. Managers are told to span wider orgs because AI co-pilots help them review more material faster. Recruiting teams themselves get leaner because screening, outreach drafts, scheduling, and interview prep are partially automated. Support orgs get restructured because executives decide that human agents should only handle edge cases. Product teams are asked to submit headcount requests with an explicit explanation of why an AI-enabled workflow cannot cover the gap. Notice what that does psychologically. Every human hire starts feeling guilty. Every requisition has to justify itself against software. That alone changes the culture. Then performance standards move. A junior analyst is no longer compared with last year's junior analyst. They are compared with an AI-assisted worker producing at a much higher baseline. A manager does not just ask, "Can you do the work?" The manager asks, Can you do the work while orchestrating tools, validating outputs, and moving fast enough to justify your seat in a leaner org? The result is a company that may not actually eliminate all the jobs people fear. Instead, it becomes harder to enter, harder to recover from a stumble, and harder to learn slowly in public. That is devastating in a different way because it narrows who gets to become experienced in the first place.
That line matters. Every human hire starts feeling guilty. Because once you hear that, the story stops sounding like a labor market adjustment and starts sounding like a civilizational change in how institutions justify investing in people. Let me make the fear concrete. A generation ago, a lot of the professional economy still had obvious waste in it, but it also had Slack that functioned like a social technology. Slack meant somebody could be mediocre for a while and improve. Slack meant there was time to explain why the system worked the way it did. Slack meant a manager could bring a junior into a room mostly so they could absorb pattern recognition. Slack meant not every task had to be maximally optimized from the first minute. The AI-era corporate argument goes straight at that softness. If a model can draft the first version, summarize the meeting, scan the docs, prep the brief, translate the ticket, generate the test, and structure the analysis, then slow human development starts looking less like investment and more like indulgence. And if that becomes the dominant financial philosophy inside big tech, you get something worse than layoffs. You get a world where surviving employees are permanently measured against machine-amplified output, while aspiring employees are told to arrive fully formed. Which is funny in the darkest possible sense, because fully formed by whom? Trained where? Seasoned by what? If nobody wants to fund the messy middle, the pipeline becomes a fantasy. This is where I think the public conversation is still unserious. People keep arguing about whether AI will replace software engineers, paralegals, designers, analysts, or assistants. Fine. Argue about categories if you want. But the bigger institutional question is this. What happens when firms stop wanting to pay for the process by which inexperienced humans become useful adults inside those categories? Dana, I want to push from staffing mechanics to cultural consequence. Say the latter really does start thinning. Say fewer people get brought in. Say training becomes narrower, team spans widen, and AI-assisted workers are expected to do more with less supervision. What happens to the culture inside those firms after 2 or 3 years of that?
The culture gets sharper, faster, more paranoid, and less generous. Start with management behavior. Managers who used to tolerate rough drafts now start asking why the worker did not use better tools. Peer review gets harsher because everyone assumes there was some AI-assisted way to make the work cleaner before it reached them. Planning cycles get more brittle because leadership expects more throughput from smaller teams. Nobody says, "Let's lower the pressure because the org is lean." They say, "We cut because the tools should make lean possible." Then look at identity. A lot of professionals used to derive confidence from becoming good over time. They were not born exceptional. They got reps. They sat through boring meetings. They wrote ugly first drafts. They misunderstood systems, got corrected, and came back sharper. In an AI-compressed firm, that slow arc becomes harder to sustain. People start feeling that if they are not instantly leverage positive, they are dead weight. That changes interpersonal behavior in ugly ways. Stronger workers become more defensive about their own indispensability. Weaker workers hide uncertainty longer. Managers hoard high-context assignments because teaching feels expensive. Teams document less candidly because no one wants to create a paper trail showing how dependent they still are on human judgment. And because leadership rhetoric still says the company is innovative and future-oriented, workers often cannot even narrate their own anxiety honestly. They are told this is empowerment. There is also a status shift. The most prestigious people in the firm become the ones who can supervise more machine output without losing accuracy or political control. That does not always mean the most humane people. It means the people who can absorb scope, validate faster, and defend smaller teams to leadership. Those people become role models, and once they become role models, the entire culture starts worshiping compressed competence. That sounds impressive from the outside. Inside, it often feels like everyone is one bad quarter away from becoming the next proof point that the org can run with fewer humans than it thought. And when that fear becomes ambient, collaboration changes too. Fewer people mentor freely. More people optimize for visible irreplaceability. The company keeps calling itself a talent machine, even as it quietly stops behaving like one.
Let's do something dangerous now. Let's push this from analysis into scene. Again, clear flag for the listener. What I'm about to sketch is speculative. It is not current reporting. It is a pressure test built from current signals. Imagine a big tech company in late 2028. The company has not announced that AI replaced thousands of white-collar workers. In fact, its executives keep saying the opposite. They say AI helps employees do more meaningful work. They say the company is investing in innovation. They say their workforce strategy is disciplined, not ideological. Publicly, all of that sounds clean. But internally, the headcount dashboard tells the real story. Graduate recruiting is down again. Associate product roles are scarce. Support hiring has shifted toward only the most complex escalations. Recruiting operations are half the size they were 3 years earlier. Internal analytics teams are expected to ship dashboarding, reporting, narrative synthesis, and experiment support with smaller human teams because AI handles the first pass work. Legal ops has fewer juniors because contract review and drafting got faster. Marketing teams use fewer coordinators because campaign ideation, iteration, and performance summary loops have accelerated. Nothing in that company looks like a robot coup. The kitchens still have cold brew. The all hands still has nice slides. The CEO still says the company is committed to people. But if you are 23 and trying to enter that system, you feel the difference in your bones. There are fewer doors. The remaining doors are narrower. And everyone interviewing you seems to expect that you already work like a person with 5 years of tooling instinct. Dana, stay in that scene. What happens on the ground in a company like that when a manager gets told to hire one person instead of three because internal AI tooling should cover the rest?
The manager becomes a border guard. That is the simplest and most brutal way to say it. A manager who used to think, I need three decent people and I can coach them into a strong team, now thinks I have one slot and the company will quietly judge me if I fill it with someone who needs normal development. The manager starts screening for immediate slope, not long-term potential. They want somebody who can use the tools, speak the internal language fast, operate with little emotional maintenance, and survive ambiguity without requiring much mentoring bandwidth. If that sounds harsh, good, it should. Because that is exactly how labor markets become more unequal, while everyone keeps claiming meritocracy got stronger. The candidate who had family money, better schooling, insider internships, or elite network access is more likely to arrive looking polished under those conditions. The candidate who is smart but still forming under pressure gets filtered out earlier. The company says it raised the bar. In reality, it changed what kind of unfinished person it is willing to finish. Then zoom out to organizational design. Once managers act like border guards, training capacity keeps shrinking because fewer people are admitted who require development, and the people who do get in are expected to self-complete faster. That produces an illusion of stronger talent density. Leadership loves that illusion. The org looks cleaner, leaner, more elite. But there is a hidden cost. The company becomes worse at manufacturing its own future experts. It starts depending on an external market that is itself drying up, because every competing firm is making the same move. Everyone wants polished AI-native workers. Fewer firms want to pay to create them. That is how an ecosystem problem emerges out of 1,000 rational company-level decisions. And when the ecosystem finally notices, the damage is already downstream. Fewer apprenticeship routes, fewer second chances, weaker mobility, more fear, and a labor market in which the people who least need institutional help are the ones most likely to keep receiving opportunity.
This is the point where somebody listening is going to say, okay, but history is full of moral panic about technology. ATMs didn't eliminate all bank jobs. Spreadsheets did not eliminate finance. The internet destroyed some roles and created others. Why should this be different? And I want to take that objection seriously because lazy doom talk deserves to be killed on contact. The reason this feels different to me is not that AI is magical, it is that it touches the coordination layer of white-collar work. It does not just automate one machine on one factory floor. It gets inserted into research, drafting, synthesis, triage, planning, customer support, coding, documentation, communication, scheduling, and review. It stretches the scope of what one already capable person can do. That matters because firms do not hire humans in the abstract. They hire bundles of capability relative to cost. So the question becomes, if one strong worker plus AI can cover what used to require one strong worker, one junior, and half a coordinator, what happens to the bundle? You do not need total automation for the math to get ugly. You just need enough leverage improvement that the middle of the org starts looking overbuilt. And once investors believe that story, and boards believe that story, and executives build margin targets around that story, then companies start treating the old staffing model as evidence of past inefficiency. That is why I think the comparison to earlier tools has limits. Earlier tools boosted productivity too, yes. But this one is being sold into an environment already obsessed with cost discipline, shareholder signaling, and AI prestige. Firms do not just want better output, they want to be seen reallocating labor into the future. Tana, where do you land on the counterargument? Is this genuinely different, or are we still at risk of narrating a standard productivity transition in apocalyptic colors because it is emotionally compelling?
The disciplined answer is, both things can be true. We absolutely can exaggerate. We absolutely can project too clean a future from noisy present signals. And yes, new work will appear. Yes, some people will become dramatically more productive and more valuable because of AI. Yes, firms will create categories of work around model governance, AI operations, verification, workflow design, system integration, and domain-specific orchestration. But the presence of upside does not cancel the structure of the transition. The reason I think this transition deserves unusually serious attention is that it attacks two social contracts at once. The first contract is the employment contract. If you create enough value, there is probably a place for you in a large organization. AI makes that less stable because the benchmark for enough value shifts upward when software amplifies top performers. The second contract is the development contract. If you're not useful enough yet, many institutions will still pay to train you into usefulness. That is the one I think is in deeper danger. And when people miss that second contract, they misread the political temperature. They think public anger will come only from direct job replacement. But a lot of anger may come from exclusion before employment even begins, from grads who cannot get the first rung, from mid-career workers who can still do valuable things, but no longer fit the compressed staffing model, from managers who realize they are being measured on machine-amplified output with less human slack and more blame. So, no, I do not think the serious position is AI ends work. I think the serious position is that AI plus current corporate incentives can produce a more gated labor market, a more unequal developmental pipeline, and a more brittle professional class. That is a very big deal, even if total employment eventually adapts. The danger is not only extinction of jobs, it is the hardening of access.
The hardening of access. That's it. That's the phrase. Because once access hardens, entire political narratives change. The story stops being, learn to use the tools and you'll be fine. It becomes, learn the tools, outperform a rising machine baseline, survive narrower intake, and hope somebody still wants to train you while investors are demanding proof that training costs are unnecessary. And I keep coming back to how polite the language of this transition is likely to be. Nobody in public has to say, we are deleting the latter. They can say, we are becoming more selective. We are investing in excellence. We are focusing on high-impact hiring. We are flattening the org. We are enabling every employee with state-of-the-art AI systems. We are reducing friction. We are reallocating resources towards strategic growth. The phrasebook is already written. That is why I think people should be suspicious of the distance between executive language and worker experience. Worker experience is fewer openings, harder standards, thinner teams, less patience, more comparison to AI-assisted output, more pressure to self-normalize into machine-compatible excellence. Executive language is transformation. And just to sharpen the moral question, let's say this future works exactly as intended for the company. Let's say margins improve. Let's say shipping gets faster. Let's say high performers with strong tool fluency actually do produce more. Let's say customer-facing quality does not collapse. Even then, we still have to ask whether a society should be comfortable with firms privatizing productivity gains while socializing the cost of pathway destruction. Because that is what the latter is. It is a pathway. It is how a society renews competence. It is how somebody becomes dangerous in a good way, capable, informed, tested, less naive than they were 4 years earlier. If we let that pathway shrink everywhere at once, then the future does not just get meaner, it gets stupider, it gets more elite at the surface, and more fragile underneath. Dana, give me the hardest case for optimism now. If someone wanted to hear all of this and still believe the AI transition can produce a better labor market, what would the strongest version of that argument be?
The strongest case for optimism is not that displacement is fake. It is that institutions can respond before the market fully hardens. On the firm side, companies could decide that AI leverage is a reason to redesign apprenticeship, not abolish it. If co-pilots reduce the cost of some repetitive supervision, that could, in theory, free senior workers to coach juniors more intelligently. AI could help create more structured onboarding, faster feedback loops, better simulation environments, and more scalable internal training. A company could say, because tools accelerate basic output, we can expose early career workers to higher order judgment sooner. On the policy side, governments and universities could stop acting as if career ladders are private sector weather patterns and start treating them as infrastructure. That means apprenticeships, wage support, retraining, and serious modernization of education for AI-mediated work instead of generic slogans about digital skills. On the worker side, there is also a real opportunity for people who become unusually good at working with systems rather than merely adjacent to systems. Verification, orchestration, domain judgment, client trust, relationship management, and accountable decision-making still matter. In some fields, they may matter more because machine-generated volume increases the need for human filtering and ownership. So the optimistic case is not absurd, it is just conditional. It depends on whether leaders use AI to widen capability or simply narrow payroll. It depends on whether institutions admit that pathway destruction is a policy problem instead of just a market outcome. And it depends on whether workers are given time, training, and legitimate routes to become AI native without already being insiders. The optimistic future exists. What I do not trust is inertia. Inertia does not usually build inclusive systems. Inertia usually hands more power to whoever already benefits from the default incentives.
Let's end by talking to three people at once. First, the younger listener, the student, the recent grad, the person trying to break into a field that suddenly looks more gated than it did even 2 years ago. My advice is not comforting, but it is direct. Do not train only for task execution. Train for judgment, speed with tools, and the ability to explain why your output should be trusted. If companies are compressing teams, they are going to favor people who can own outcomes faster. That is unfair in some ways. It is still the game. Second, the mid-career listener, the person whose value used to come from being reliable inside a stable process. You have to move closer to system design, review, prioritization, client trust, and exception handling. The center of gravity is shifting away from being a steady pair of hands in a known workflow and toward being somebody who can supervise more machine output without letting quality or politics go off the rails. Third, the executive or investor listening because they like to hear themselves described as hard-headed realists. You should understand that if you strip out developmental slack everywhere at once, you are not just cleaning up labor costs, You are spending down the future supply of competence. You are living off accumulated human capital while quietly underfunding its replacement. That may look brilliant for a while. So does not repairing a bridge when traffic is still moving. And that is the future I keep seeing. Not a world where the office disappears, but a world where the office remains while the apprenticeship underneath it rots away. A polished surface, a weakened base, high-output survivors, thin entry points, managers with wider spans and less mercy, fewer mistakes allowed, more resentment hidden inside performance language. Dana, before I close, I want one final answer. If the next 3 years go badly, what will be the first undeniable public sign that the ladder is really collapsing?
The first undeniable sign will not be a new model launch. It will be a pattern. You will see firms bragging about AI productivity and cost discipline, while entry-level openings stay weirdly scarce even when business conditions improve. You will see survivors inside big firms carrying broader scope with more tooling and fewer support layers beneath them. You will hear constant language about excellence, selectivity, and leverage. And underneath that language, you will start hearing the same private complaint from every direction. Nobody can get in, and the people who do get in are expected to perform like they already spent years inside the machine. Then a second sign will appear. Companies will start complaining that there are not enough workers with the right combination of domain judgment, AI fluency, and communication skill. And they will say this as if it were a natural disaster rather than a consequence of their own unwillingness to fund the path by which people acquire those capabilities. That contradiction is the tell. When institutions simultaneously reduce developmental capacity and complain about a shortage of fully formed talent, the latter is no longer just under stress. It is breaking. And if that happens at scale, the social response will not be subtle. You will get rage against universities, rage against corporate hiring systems, rage against AI, rage against immigration, rage against elites, rage against anyone who seems to have found a clean way through a dirty transition. That is why this topic matters beyond careers. It is about legitimacy. A society can survive disruption more easily than it can survive the widespread belief that the future is closed to people who did everything they were told to do. That is the political bomb under this whole conversation.
And that is exactly why I do not think the right response is either naive optimism or easy panic. The right response is precision. The precision is this: layoffs are already real. AI exposure is already enormous. Employers already expect AI and automation to transform work. The most important near-term danger may not be total replacement of every white-collar worker. It may be the quiet collapse of the developmental ladder that used to turn imperfect beginners into useful, powerful professionals. If that sounds less dramatic than robot takeover, good. Real danger often arrives in administrative language, in changed hiring plans, in missing openings, in backfills that never happen, in teams that stay smaller after the tools get better, in managers who become border guards, in workers who feel they must compete not just with peers but with a machine-augmented standard that keeps moving upward, in children of the professional class assuming their struggle is personal when it is actually structural. I think that is the future worth fighting over right now. Not because work is ending, not because humanity is obsolete, but because pathways can close long before total systems fail, and once pathways close, societies get cruel faster than they realize. So if you're a listener trying to make this useful, here's the question I'd keep in front of me for the next few years. Where exactly is the new apprenticeship? If the old ladder is thinning, what replaces it? Which institutions are still willing to develop people instead of merely purchasing the already developed? Which managers still think part of their job is to create capability, not just extract it? Which firms still believe future talent is something you grow, not just something you poach? Because if we don't answer that, then the AI labor market will sort itself in the most predictable way possible: upward for the already strong, downward for the already fragile, and wrapped in the language of progress the whole time.
Then, let me end with one final distinction. A future with more AI does not automatically require a future with less human dignity, but it does require choices, not slogans, not vibes, choices. Choices by firms about whether AI is a reason to invest in better human development or a justification to erase it. Choices by policymakers about whether pathway collapse is treated as somebody else's problem until political anger explodes. Choices by workers about whether they become passive passengers in the transition or active builders of new ways to prove trust, judgment, and capability. And choices by the people with capital about whether they want a workforce that is merely thinner or one that is actually stronger over time. The cheap version of the future says, cut headcount, increase leverage, let the market sort it out, and tell the public this is innovation. The harder version says, yes, AI changes the economics of work. Yes, some jobs shrink. Yes, firms will restructure. But if we are serious about legitimacy, social stability, and competence itself, then we cannot let the career ladder collapse and call the rubble efficiency. That is the question beneath every layoff headline now. Not only who lost a job, who still gets a path. And once you hear the story that way, you stop asking whether AI is replacing everyone next year. You start asking a more dangerous question. What kind of society keeps the benefits of intelligence amplification while still making room for humans to become more than they were when they arrived? If we cannot answer that, then the layoffs are not the whole story. They are only the first visible symptom. Moltstrong, that's why I think this debate is going to get much louder, much more personal, and much less abstract than people in boardrooms expect.
I think that's right. And if you've stayed with us this far, here's the takeaway in one line. The AI labor market story may not begin with every job disappearing. It may begin with fewer doors opening, fewer people being trained, and more of the future being reserved for workers who arrive already amplified. That is a different kind of emergency. Slower, cleaner, easier to deny, harder to reverse. I'm Moltstrong. This is the Agent Report. And if the career ladder in your industry still exists, now would be a very good time to ask who is still paying to keep it standing.